Just a quick update on the CRC issues. The one update I wanted to do is that in our presentation yesterday, the DG indicated that there are about 40 people outstanding to be traced. I've just received a report saying that a small improvement. The number has now been reduced to about 34. 34. And of the 34, the beneficiaries that are still to be traced is 23. It's now down to 23. The DG reported yesterday that we have 7 people living overseas. That we are still trying to reach and get their responses. The DG indicated 2 addresses are unknown. I don't think we didn't mention that there are 2 beneficiaries who we know, who we have approached, but they refuse to accept their reparations. And they refuse on the basis that they don't want to be declared victims. They see themselves as activists. And so we have that situation. Just 2, yeah. So all in all, really, I think the number is now down from 40 to 34. So that's the one issue. The second issue is regards to regulations. We are just happy to report that we are now in a situation where the Minister of Basic Education, the Minister of Higher Education, have now confirmed in writing that they are happy with the regulations. We can go ahead. The only outstanding will be the Minister of Health. Initially, the Minister of Health had indicated he's happy, but the Minister of Finance is proposing that the model we propose should just be converted where the TRC beneficiaries get free medical health because of the small number. So that's the issue that the Minister of Health needs to respond to. I've met the Health Department 2 days ago. Unfortunately, the officials I met were not properly mandated. So through the DG, we'll approach both the DG of Health and the Minister of Health just to sort it out. So in all fairness, I think of the 3 regulations we're busy with, 2 are done. We are left with 1. That must be sorted out. From there, the issue is, what is the next step? The next step will be the following. Once the Minister of Finance has agreed that we should use the President's fund on the basis of the regulations, the legislation require us that the President needs to just sign off on the regulations. We must then determine a date of commencement that must be published in the Gazette to let all stakeholders, including Parliament, when will the implementation of the regulations commence. So that is where we are. In terms of community rehabilitation, the DG has indicated that I think the chair and the portfolio committee will recall that last day I came and presented the 18 communities we are starting with. We have already started with Mamelodi and Alexandra. Alexandra is quite clear what it wants to do. It wants a memorial park. Mamelodi is meeting this Saturday just to make up their mind about what they want. Our next plan is to now tackle KZN. And then we'll follow with other provinces. I was asked a question yesterday about, and I think this is a point that the DG mentioned. She said that we're experiencing some resistance, particularly from civil society. And the question arose as to what our points of difference is. There are 2 major points of difference. The one point of difference is that we are constantly challenged that we can't only operate on the closed list. We need to open up the list. There's an organization called Kulumani, which is a member of the Coalition on Transitional Justice. It says that it has determined that between 65,000 and 150,000 people have been left out of the process. Now, we've been saying our mandate as the department is only confined to the 16,800 people who have applied. Nothing more, nothing less. Because if you add 65,000 or if you even add 150,000, first of all, you must be allowed by law to do that. But secondly, you have to think about where you get the resources for that. And we all know that even the billion that we have is not even enough to tackle that. So I think that is the first major point of difference. The second major point of difference is around implementation of community rehabilitation. I will not be surprised if you have also received a letter from the Legal Resources Center, basically in which their Coalition on Transitional Justice complains about how we are going on about implementing community rehabilitation. They say the following. The one is that we are disbursing funds in communities without proper regulations. That's the one allegation. The second allegation is that the Department of Justice has distributed money to municipalities to assist municipalities to make improvements in various communities. Now, the real situation is the following, and we have now finalized the report, I think, which through the DG will be distributed to various stakeholders. For us to be able to prepare regulations on community rehabilitation, we need to do needs analysis. And to do needs analysis, we need to consult various communities to understand what their needs are, because the regulations that we do need to be informed. Now, in terms of the needs analysis, there are no costs that are being defrayed from the President's fund. We are using the department's own vote. So we are not using any money from the President's fund. But secondly, we have not distributed any money to any municipality. So we don't know where the idea comes from. I think the idea came from knowing that we have been moving through various communities to consult them, as we indicated to Parliament last year. So I think those are really the major points of difference, closed list versus open list, and our approach on community rehabilitation. There was a question about whether we have not moved very slow on tracing people. I think that perception is correct. It's correct to an extent that if we knew what we know now, I think we would have done things a lot faster. As you know, Chair, they always say that hindsight is the perfect sight. I think TRC is one model where outsourcing never worked, because we started by appointing a tracing agent to assist staff. It didn't deliver. It is only when we used our own resources, when we used our own staff, and particularly the use of regional offices has really, really been of tremendous help in tracing people. We did use radio to some extent, but I think what really took us this far, remember 2 years ago when we came to this committee, we said that we are looking for 875 people. A year ago, we then said we are looking for 440 people. Today, we are down to really 23 people. And it's really because of regional offices and the task team we put in place. But also, I think the pushing from the committee, the pushing from the DG and the minister have really all been of great benefit. So really, that's where we are with the TRC. On off-site storage, there was a question about off-site storage, if I may just deal with that. When the committee visited the South Gauteng High Court last year, unfortunately it was at a time where we had closed our payments as a department. And we did so because in the context of financial constraints, we wanted to manage our cash flow. And as a consequence of that, certain service providers couldn't be paid, including the service provider on off-site storage. So the consequence of that was that the service provider himself could not pay the owner of the storage where we are storing the files and so on. So that's where files were held, and that's why there was so many problems that were then reported to yourselves. But we are happy to report that since then, the situation has really, really improved. That problem has been eliminated completely. Payments were made by the department. There are no reports whatsoever of courts not receiving their files as required. In fact, In the 7 courts where we have rolled out the system, in Krugersdorp Magistrate, in Pretoria Magistrate, in Johannesburg Magistrate, Durban Magistrate, North and South Gauteng High Court and Western Cape High Court, the system is working very well. And the DG was really correct when she said that in the Western Cape, the system is most advanced. And I think it's largely because of the attitude of the management in the Western Cape. I think a major weakness that we saw in the system was that when the files were transferred to the service provider for digitization to take place, I think in some courts, particularly in Johannesburg Magistrate Court, our staff were not vigilant enough to make sure that everything that is digitized is 100% correct. They just handed over to files to the service provider. And obviously, the service provider being outside from the justice system, you know, wasn't really convinced with the quality of the files and so on. But going forward, I think that's the issue we will take care of. And I think at an appropriate time, we'll invite the portfolio committee to go and witness the system at the Western Cape High Court to see how it's working. I'm also just happy to report that the DG has just approved that the project must now also tackle the Devon High Court as well as the Labour Court. That's where we are focused. I think that's all the questions I had to thank you. With regard to corruption in the registrar's office in South Gauteng, I know that there's an investigation that is ongoing at the moment. It's carried out by both the Hawks and the SIU. I think it's a matter of us looking for a report from there. We haven't received the report yet. As soon as the report is ready, we'll inform the committee accordingly. Thanks, Chair.
Members, DG and your team, the Minister was on Morning Live this morning. I missed it because I had to leave before he came on. I know this because they spoke about the Small Claims Court. I was in and out of the bathroom, and then I peeped and heard Small Claims, saw your pamphlet, went back, put on my tie, and then I heard, oh, the Minister's going to appear. So I don't know how that went. I hope it went well. Regulations, Doctor. Does the law require that they be tabled here in Parliament? Do you know? No requirement.
Corruption issue. I mean, the SIU is, as we know, experiencing problems, and I understand those investigations are taking a long time, far longer than they used to. Have you followed up with the SIU? Because I don't think that this kind of corruption issue can be left to just wait for them to finish their investigation. I'm waiting for the Hawks to finish an investigation from 2 years ago. And I mean, if we have registrars in the courts continuing to, you know, fortunately issue court orders, that's not something that we can sit around and wait for them to finish. I can't remember if Dean asked yesterday, but there was that other issue of the court in, I think, Soweto, where there was allegations of jobs being inappropriately awarded. She did ask that. I haven't received an answer on that, I don't think. Okay, you're still going to get there. Okay.
Chair, I think just the clarity question is welcome. Indeed, it is correct that there are a number of investigations that the SIU is currently handling, and we know this because we do. Of course, in justice, we have commissioned it's one investigation for one area, but in two regions. Okay. And that is in the Guardian Fund. And now that we are talking about Amat as well, just deal with that as well. But before I deal with that, let me answer the question specifically. When the matter first arose, I personally met with the National Commissioner of Police, and I requested prioritization of the matter. I wrote formally, and I requested prioritization. I met with the head of the Hawks together with Dr. De Vere, and we gave them a copy of the letter that was responding to the Honorable Judge Mojapilo. who had raised this issue with me. And I said, this issue is slightly beyond us in terms of just the investigation. It needs someone who, it needs capacity at that level. Subsequent to that, the project, then I handed the project over to Dr. De Vier, who then met with them a few times. He then informed me that the SIUs had been brought in to try and bring some level of speciality in investigating this matter. Now, a lot has since happened since then, but we have not received a formal report. I have written to the SIU, not specifically on the registrar's issue, but on the investigations that I'd like to touch on quickly as well. It is a fact that these investigations are delayed, but I don't think they're delayed for any other reason other than the fact that the SIU's bladder is full. If my memory serves me well, I think about how many proclamations? Currently, there is just a huge number of proclamations that have been issued in the recent times, and therefore I do think that they are stretched a bit. So, but it's an issue that after the resolution of the issues of the fees for the SIUs in terms of the legislation that was passed recently, the SIU is now looking at additional capacity just to help them. But in addition, in terms of the CARA allocation, they are also looking for additional capacity using the CARA money just to fast-track the investigation. So I understand, I appreciate the concern, and it is a concern of ours as well, but there are a number of interventions to resource the SIU and the HOC in the special investigations of these matters that we are dealing with.
Just clarity, I mean, can I ask, has the official that's been allegedly done these things still working there, or are they suspended?
I'm not able to answer the question because at this stage I do not know the official who has been actually doing the fraudulent, court orders. No. Thank you. Chair, if I may request Lawrence to deal with all the matters of legislation that we asked him to do.
Very good. We are a bit worried about this. I may as well tell you, Mr. Bassett, AG, because this is one of those bad years when we're on the verge of the election, and we've always got to figure out program, you know. But Mr. Bassett's been here long enough, so he's very aware of it. Our main concern is Section 76 bills, because with Section 76 bills, we tend to work backwards from December, assuming the elections are in April, and that we will close sometime in December, we don't know. Then we work back from there and make sure that with Section 76s, we give the NCOP sufficient time to do their processes. So please, if you're going to come with a Section 76 in October, well, you know, it just won't happen. Yeah. All right.
Thank you, Chair. Can I start off? I think there were questions raised yesterday about legislation relating to the Solicitor General, to the designation and training of magistrates in terms of PIA, and then also for the, I don't want to call them dedicated sexual offences courts. I'm not too sure whether that's what they're going to be called at the end of the day. Maybe I should just, for purposes of this discussion, do that. Chair, there was a suggestion also yesterday that why don't we get a bill dealing with, and reference was made specifically to sexual offences relating to the dedicated sexual offences courts, get a bill to Parliament quickly and take it through Parliament.
Yes.
What we are planning to do just that. We have already drafted a bill, but this bill, it'll be another Judicial Matters Amendment bill. It's a very convenient vehicle to get all sorts of amendments through Parliament quickly. And what we plan to do with this Judicial Matters Amendment bill is to include the amendments relating to the Solicitor General, to include the amendments relating to PAIA, as well as sexual offences, and possibly also the delinking of the SAJE from the department to the, I think it's to the office of the Chief Justice. So those will, they really will be technical amendments, and I would like to think that they'll go through Parliament quite quickly without too many problems. Chair, maybe let me start with the PAIA amendments. They actually originated from a question raised by this committee. I think the question was raised whether the department intends amending Section 91A of PAIA, which deals with the training and designation of magistrates to deal with PAIA-related matters. We don't intend repealing that provision, but to amend that provision. And I would like to just remind members what that provision says. It says the head of an administrative region, those are your chief magistrates, must designate in writing any magistrate or additional magistrate as a presiding officer of a magistrate's court that has been designated by the minister in terms of Section 1 to deal with PAIA-related issues. So that designation, the minister designates the courts, magistrates' courts, district courts, which will deal with PAIA matters, and then the chief magistrate designates magistrates, individual magistrates to deal with those matters in his or her courts, but can only do so if that magistrate has been trained. Only a magistrate or additional magistrate who has completed a training course and whose name has been included in the list contemplated in that section may be designated. The heads of administrative regions, that's your chief magistrates, must take all reasonable steps within available resources to designate at least one magistrate for each court, and without delay inform the Director General Justice of magistrates who have completed the training courses and who have been designated. The Director General must compile and keep a list of every magistrate who has completed the training course and who has been designated. Then subsection 5 requires the Chief Justice, in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission and the Magistrates Commission, to develop the content of the training courses with a view to building a dedicated and experienced pool of trained and specialized presiding officers. The Chief Justice must, in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission, the Magistrates Commission and the Minister, implement those training courses. And then the minister must table a report in Parliament as prescribed relating to the content of those courses and the implementation of those courses. So that's what Section 91A does. Chair, it's not only PAIA that has provisions of this nature. PAJA and PAPUDA have exactly the same. So if we're going to amend Section 91A, we must do all three acts. And that's what our bill does at this stage. And then in a nutshell, what the amendments do, or perhaps before we get to the amendments, the question also arose that these amendments were enacted in 2008 or 2010, regional courts also got civil jurisdiction. So while Section 91A of PAIA only gives just jurisdiction to district courts to deal with PAIA-related issues, the question is being raised, shouldn't we broaden the definition of court to include regional courts? And this request came from the regional courts themselves. There are a number of magistrates who were district court magistrates who've been trained for purposes of dealing with these matters. They are now in the regional courts. They're anxious to do it. They want to use the experience and training that they've gone through. So the question arises, and that's, should we broaden the scope of magistrates' courts? They are dealt with in the high courts and are intended to be dealt with in the district courts. Our amendment at this stage broadens the scope to include regional courts as well. But then what the amendment does, and it transfers, as I said earlier, the DG Justice has a responsibility of keeping a list of all the magistrates who've been trained and designated. What the amendment does is to transfer that responsibility either to the Office of the Chief Justice or to the Magistrates Commission. And we've left that open. where we are with these amendments. We've sent it to the Office of the Chief Justice and we've sent it to the Magistrates Commission for comments. We're hoping the Magistrates Commission indicated that they give us comments by today. So we want to move with these amendments as soon as we possibly can. So what we're doing here, we will also do with the other two acts. And then we're also making a suggestion, Chair, that the last three subsections in Section 91A, which require the Chief Justice to develop the content of the training courses, which require the Chief Justice to implement the training courses, and which require the Minister to table a report on the content and the implementation of those courses in Parliament. The question is raised, all those administrative functions, are they really necessary? SAJ must report. We are proposing that SAJ will be responsible for the development and implementation of those training courses, not the Chief Justice in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission. So we're transferring that responsibility to SAJ. If that is agreed to, SAJ has got to report to Parliament on its activities each year. Then the question arises, why all this extra administration? Why must the Chief Justice table? Why must the Chief Justice do all these things in consultation with the other functionaries when it will, as a matter of course, take place in the SAJA activity? So that's the basis of those amendments, and we are really hoping, we are pushing it, and we're trying to get those amendments to Parliament as soon as possible. I also want to say that there is another Judicial Matters Amendment Bill that's on the verge of being introduced into Parliament. That's a big bill. I think there are about 48 clauses. We can't put these amendments in there because they still have to go to Cabinet, but we want to try and get them to Cabinet as soon as possible. Chair, then the other amendments that we want to do in this new Judicial Matters Amendment Bill is relating to the sexual offences and to give the Minister the power to designate courts as dedicated sexual offences courts. And they will be more or less along the lines of what I have just said, the way your prior magistrates' courts are designated. So I can just get to the draft provision. It would go along the following lines, more or less. The Minister may, from time to time, whenever the need arises, in or after consultation with the Chief Justice and the head of the court in question, by notice in the Gazette, designate any magistrate's court, any division of the High Court, or, well, it will boil down to any High Court or any magistrate's court. That is either a regional court or district court, although I should imagine most of these cases will be dealt with in regional courts, as a sexual offences court to deal with sexual offences courts, and may make any regulations necessary to give effect to the designation of the courts that are going to be designated, including the requirements for the efficient and effective functioning thereof. So the regulations can determine the specs that are already being spoken about. What we also do is to say that this section may not be interpreted as including any other court from dealing with matters relating to sexual offences. So although you'll have your dedicated sexual offences courts where the need arises, with all the technicalities and all the equipment that are required there, we don't want a situation arising where your magistrate's court that hasn't been designated is saying, we're not going to see all those matters because it should go to a designated a court. So that's what we're doing as far as the sexual offences is concerned. On the Solicitor General, and this is the last of the three sets that we will be dealing with in the short judicial matters. It was mentioned yesterday quite correctly, the State Attorneys Act is very old, it's the 1957 Act. The structure of the State Attorneys is also rather strange. It provides in Section 2 that the Minister of Justice may, subject to the laws governing the public service, appoint as State Attorney a person admitted and entitled to practice as an attorney in any division of the Supreme Court of South Africa who is in charge of the State Attorney's Office, and the State Attorney's Office is specifically, it says so in legislation, is the Pretoria Office. But then the State Attorney Act goes on to say that the Minister may also establish branches and put in place heads of those branches. But there's no direct or very specific provision in the State Attorney's Act to say who's in overall charge of the State Attorneys, and I think that's what gives rise to some of the problems and challenges that are being experienced. The way the Act is written and the way the Office of the State Attorney is structured. I think there are quite a few committee members that will remember in 2005, I think it was, where we did a similar thing for the Master's Office. We created a Chief Master. So that's the intention with the amendment of Section 2 of the State Attorney's Act to create a Chief State Attorney, possibly to be called the Solicitor General. The Solicitor General will be the executive office, and this wording is taken from the Administration of the States Act when we did the Chief Master. Is the executive officer of the Office of the State Attorney and any branch exercises control, direction, and supervision over the Office of the State Attorney and any branch thereof. That is the crux of that amendment, and then maybe I can just say that the functions and powers and duties of the Solicitor General, she will determine policy relating, these are just some ideas, this is a draft amendment, determine policy relating to the functions of the Office of the State Attorney, which includes the branches, which must include the following aspects: the coordination and management of all litigation in which the state is involved, briefing of counsel, outsourcing of legal work, including the instruction of correspondence, and initiating, defending, and opposing of matters, including the circumstances and manner in which alternative dispute resolution and arbitration proceedings must or may be applied, and issue policy directives and standards in respect thereof. So it is fashioned along the lines of what happened to a large extent with the Office of the Chief Master. I don't want to go into any further detail. I think at a broad level, those are what the amendment's about. Chair. Thank you.
All right, I've got Schaefer, Jeffrey, Steve Swart.
Thanks. Just on the sexual offence courts, I mean, as far as I understand, if it's going to be along the lines of the prior magistrates, it will be people who choose to specialise in and undertake the training. My concern still remains, what happens if there aren't sufficient magistrates who are prepared to do that? Should we not be making it slightly more compulsory somehow?
And the Magistrates Commission? They won't be getting...
Commission, we're meeting tomorrow, Magistrates Commission, and it is on the agenda for tomorrow. I wondered what it was about, so now I'm glad I know. Thank you.
Jeffrey.
Just on the Sexual Offences Court, maybe, and if the point I'd raised about yesterday around the possibility of allowing the Circuit Court could be looked at. It may be necessary to put that, because it would mean a court coming into another magistrate's court jurisdiction. And in the rural areas that may work. Okay, you won't have the facilities of the cameras and TV monitors and things like that, but at least you will have the expertise from the magistrate and the prosecutor, so that issue could be looked at. Then just on I missed a bit of the issue on PAYA. Where is this amendment coming from? I hope it's not coming from us. Is it? Well, it was coming from Mrs. Schaefer. Okay. Because I don't think it is. I mean, look, the concern was that, I'm not sure I am in favor of it, in terms of the concern was about the fact that magistrates were not trained so that they couldn't adjudicate on prior disputes. But I'm just really afraid of untrained magistrates adjudicating on prior disputes, and I become more afraid of untrained magistrates adjudicating on PAJA and the Equality Court. I mean, can you imagine Magistrate Prince?
That's what the bill is providing for trained magistrates.
For trained magistrates, yes. Okay.
It's going to provide for magistrates to be trained and so on.
So what's the difference? There is a requirement that they're trained at the moment for PAYA.
Well, Yeah, you missed part of it.
But anyway, but okay, maybe you can just, but before that, what I then don't understand is the issue of extending the jurisdiction to regional courts.
Okay.
And the argument Mr. Bassett had was that that was a request from the magistrates because they'd been trained as district magistrates, the regional court magistrates. Now, you know, how are you going to distinguish between a district court magistrate's PIA matter or equality court matter and a regional court one? Are you going to say, well, with access to information, if you're looking for 50 pages, then you go to the district court, but if you're only looking for 10, I mean, for you go to the regional court. If you're only looking for 10 pages, then you go to the district court. I don't know how it's going to, how would it work? In the equality court, if somebody calls you, like, you know, that you have differing degrees of being discriminated against, you know, how is it going to work? So I think there may be some practical problems there, and I think we need to be quite careful of that, because the intention was to have easy access for resolving these disputes, which you get at district court, you don't get so much at a regional court. And I don't sort of see the point, even though the regional courts now have civil jurisdiction, why should they deal with these matters?
All right. Hang on, Mr. Professor. Mr. Swart?
Just from the sexual offences courts, the concern is obviously about the delays. And I'm just trying to understand the delays caused now by the legislation that needs to be passed. It is not possible for us to pass a very quick bill to deal with that specific aspect should the committee hold that view, because the minister has already announced that those courts are going to be implemented. And I'd like to just hear from Mr. Bassett his views on that. But you also said that that doesn't, the other magistrates' courts are still doing the work. So I'm trying to understand the rationale. Why do we then have to designate sexual offences courts? When we had previously specialised sexual offences courts, they weren't designated. So I just need to understand the motivation for that. Can't one just go back to the previous situation where certain courts did that work? Purely because of the delay. If we agree that there is a need then for the designation process, then isn't there a way and to fast-track that legislation, considering the public outrage around that specific incident and incidents of rape and sexual offence.
All right, Mr. Bassett. Thank you, Chair. we'll consider the circuit courts and what Ms. Schaefer also requested to have a look at making it more compulsory. Why the designation? I must say I also asked that question, but I think there's a feeling that there is a need for the legislation, and maybe my colleagues from court services, from vulnerable groups can help me here. I think it's more in the courts themselves where there is a challenge, because as Mr. Swart says, this was dealt with on an administrative basis in the past, and it can continue to be so. We don't even have to wait for the legislation. We can start implementing these dedicated special courts to the extent possible while the legislation is in the making. To get to Mr. Jeffrey's question about the regional courts, it's a question that we've also grappled with. As I say, this is a draft, and we welcome this opportunity to hear the views. It can lead to forum shopping. We're concerned about that. There are, in most cases, your PAIA-related issues and your PAPUDA-related issues aren't really, in terms of monetary, where you can say, okay, anything over this amount must go to the regional court. There are a few instances, and I haven't got the act in front of me in terms of PAIA that come to mind, where the court order could sound in money or have a bearing on financial issues, but most of your cases will not be like that. So there is that challenge that we have to face, and we have asked that question ourselves, and it would be very useful to get guidance on that specific aspect. I think
maybe also on Mr. Swart's point on taking sexual offences out into a special bill. I mean, maybe for the department to look at that, and also even to look at whether they want it to be a committee bill. I mean, in many parliaments, the executive come to a private member and say, do this bill first because it will be quicker. We want it urgently, rather than it going through the whole executive process. So that's something also to look at. And then, Chair, while we're on that point, just because of the experiences of yesterday morning, the Constitution, new Constitution, well, still on the 18th Amendment bill, on only the Minister of Justice may introduce bills affecting the courts. We need to continue with that, and that was going to be a committee bill. I don't know if the DG is aware of it, but it's basically a concern arising from the 17th Amendment and, you know, an act of Parliament not providing that the competition appeal and labour appeal don't go to the SCA if an act of Parliament determines otherwise. To say that, look, like money bills, only the Minister of Justice should introduce bills affecting the courts. And we had it yesterday with the Labour Relations Amendment Bill, where they, in fact, were duplicating provisions already in the Constitutional Amendment. In the Superior Courts Bill. And we're quite keen as a committee as a whole on an amendment to that effect. I think the Minister informally is in agreement, but we need to look at how we continue with that, because I think yesterday just shows how there can be problems.
Essentially, everyone wants their own court. No, really, they do. And they really honestly believe that it's just a case of establishing it and passing legislation. And it doesn't work like that. Mr. Bassett.
Sorry, Chair, I didn't respond to your question about 76 bills. The only one that I could think of that is going to be 76, or in fact is, unless things have changed, is the legal practice bill. And I know there is uncertainty and a concern about that. The other possibility is our determination of remuneration of commissioners of Chapter 9 institutions. We are amending the Public Protector Act, and I think that also requires a Section 76 procedure, but we haven't got to that stage yet, and that could be another one, but for the rest it's all 75.
Good morning, Chairperson. Mine is to answer on the Masters issues and the Guardians Fund and the OSD with regards to Deputy Masters. Let me try and deal with the OSD and Deputy Masters first. We are under the same constraints as all the other OSD members of the department, and we are following suit with developments there. Where there are negotiations with the Public Service Commission and so on. The Deputy Masters are at a slightly lower grading than other OSD members, but that has been determined by proper processes, and we will seek to have that attended to in the same group of discussions. So that is nothing new or peculiar to Deputy Masters. I am unable to give a time frame. Each matters that are dealt with by the department collectively in liaison with the OSD and the public service. Maybe my colleagues from HR can help us a bit better with time frames on that. Just to say that the Deputy Masters are no different than other members. I remember the previous session we had the registrars of the High Court with similar issues, but it's under one blanket, so to speak. The next issue, if I may, address the issue of the Guardians Fund being centralized and how far are we. I've endeavored to put in the hand of all the members a pamphlet that we have issued, which really deals with the whole Guardians Fund as a whole. How do we access the Guardians Fund? What forms need to be completed, where to go to, exact name, contact details, places, having made the Guardian Fund now available in 29 places. It is perhaps easier said than done, because we are guarding our no audit qualification and our control on fraud and corruption in this area with a very, very firm hand. And within our limited resources, that is how far we could take it and still ensure proper compliance and safeguard. What it means, the 29 places, is that a person can go into that office, be verified, fill in documents, and then go back to his or her place of residence and will then receive the payment by electronic fund transfer. We've made massive progress in paying people by EFT and limiting the risk of cheque fraud and other challenges that we had around that. It's part of the overall EFT process, which I'm sure the CFO will speak to a little in more detail later. The remaining issue is that of Bushbuck Ridge, and I want to give Honourable Member Sitoli the assurance that we are working very hard at it. I want to remind you that on page 23, paragraph 3.2, we've listed severe constraints as a result of budget cuts, the unavailability of staff and equipment due to funds restriction, but within our means, we will be able to place in that particular area a full-time member who will be able to assist using the latest paperless estate administration process to process matters. We do that on a volume basis and also site readiness in terms of scanners and other IT equipment. So Bushbuck Ridge will be done very shortly. Maybe in closing, if I can just refer to the question around ICMS trusts. That was a matter that was on our program last year and somehow seemed to have disappeared this year. The reason for that is the final development of that has been done. The final user acceptance tests have been concluded. We are finishing off the polishing of the product so that it will go live expectedly around about the 10th of June. So it's a job completed and done. Thank you.
Good morning and thank you, Chairperson. I'll possibly try to address four questions. The first one is the funding for protection of personal information. We put aside 23.4 million over the next 3 years, 7 million, 8 million, and 8.4 million over the next 3 years. Secondly, in relation to the procurement of laptops for judges and magistrates, our target is to procure 1,874. Now, this is for the replacement of out-of-warranty laptops. We've procured 1,600. We've identified 1,724 magistrates and 154 judges whose laptops were out of warranty. So we've already procured 1,600. The deficit we'll procure now in the first quarter of the new financial year. We are busy deploying these laptops to the respective members of the judiciary. There were questions on the funding of the Tuzela centers. Treasury supported us this time around by through a cash injection of 18, 19, and 20 million rand over the next 3 years. Now, there is funding that is directed to the National Prosecuting Authority. For us, in finance, if appropriate framework is concluded on support to NGOs, then we can, together with National Treasury guidance, possibly within a framework, facilitate assistance to NGOs. Again, it depends on whether it is within our mandate. The Treasury framework of financial reporting makes provision for transfer payments to non-governmental institutions. So the facility is there. It is just the line function, together with the stakeholders, needs to conclude. And from there, we possibly can see how we can implement it. In relation to infrastructure, later when I will do the budget presentation, in the E&E documentation, there's a two-pager that clearly indicates over a seven-year period what is the justice infrastructure amendment plan. It will tell you exactly which court, the Nyausbury court, what is the cost of the court, what is the planned expenditure over six, seven-year period, the same for the Limpopo High Court, and then for each of the other courts which we've completed in the last 3 years, and also those, the first set of cash flows for the next 3 years, of the financial year. But it is an annexure in the tabled document, budget documentation by the Minister of Finance, but I can just later on reflect and quickly show it to the members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And honourable members, there's a few other questions that I will deal with on sexual offences. I think there was a question around how we will deal with the resistance. Part of the plan is that we will provide training, but especially psychosocial support, because the people that work in these courts, they tend to burn out because of the issues that that come before the court. So we will build into the rollout the psychosocial support so that, you know, people can cope. But we're also hoping that the training will, should include a broader pool of people so that you can then have rotation, you know, so that, you know, you don't expose the same people to the same sort of environment over a period of time. And this training would and support would include both the judiciary, the prosecutors, as well as the administrative staff. And then there was an issue around the measure of the registers. I think it's a matter that Parliament has been concerned about for quite some time. We've actually met with the DSD to look into the measure, and we've come to a conclusion as a task team that the two registers should indeed be merged. And that the one common register should then be located within DSD. Our colleagues from DSC have requested that their minister would like to study the proposal to understand its impact in terms of the capacities that they need to develop, as well as the systems that they need to place, that they need to put into place before they can, you know, take over the function. So from our side, we've actually concluded the process. So we will await, further development from the side of the DSD. There was also an issue around the historical data, Chairperson. We are dealing with that. We've put up, we've appointed people. We've got the data from SARS. We've split up or disaggregated the data to understand the number of cases per province. So we've got the data in terms of the cases, how many are in Gauteng, Northwest, and all that. Within all the provinces, there's also cases that come from outside South Africa. I think Zambia, Swaziland, and Lesotho, if I remember correctly. So once you've appointed the people, they will then work in the regions and go into the courts and, you know, extract the historical data, and then they will then upload them onto the system that ISM is now developing. So we're hoping that in the next month or so, the people will actually start. We've tested, you know, how long it actually takes by working in Pretoria Magistrate Court, just to get a sense of how long would this entire process take us. And then, Chairperson, there was a question around the number of dedicated sexual offences courts. Originally, we talked about 42. But when we looked at the list that was submitted, we realized that some provinces actually had submitted less, and that it would actually deny access, you know, to others. So we then said, look, can we increase the number? And that's how we got to the number of 57. And I need to say that, Chair, that the final report has not been placed for the minister. So the number may stay 57 or it might change. But as things stand, that is the number that we have proposed, that we have the 57 sexual offences court. I think Mr. Bassett dealt with the issue on legislation, and I think we will follow the suggestion that is proposed on the easy way of how to deal with the legislation. There was also an issue on the one-stop child justice centres. you will recall that the DG presented that we had concluded Matlosana, it is operational. There is also one that is has been developed in the Northern Cape, which is also operational. But I think last year there were concerns raised around the guidelines that we need to develop. So we are looking into those guidelines as to what should inform the establishment of a one-stop child justice center, what should be the criteria, and so forth, so that, you know, there is some logic as to what informs the establishment of those one-stop child justice centers. Yes, Chair, I think that should conclude the issues, you know, from court services side. Thank you.
The issue, I had asked yesterday if we could get a list of the 40 whatever courts that are existing, and I think some of them were operational, some of them have the equipment but are not operational, so obviously the distinguishing bit, and then the 56 or 57, and then if you could extract, I thought there was agreement, if you could extract out of the report the criteria for a sexual offences court, what is going to be there. I had asked for that yesterday. If it's not ready now, can we get it after lunch? And then just to confirm on the one-stop child justice centre, I think I'm very pleased that the department is looking at the criteria, because I think with the sexual offences courts, you're basing it on the placing on the number of sexual offences in that magisterial district. Whereas with child justice centres, I don't understand why each metro, why the focus isn't on the metros, because one would imagine that most of the child offenders are in metros, and if you have one for a city, for a metro, you can actually use it for a number of magisterial districts. But yet it's only Bloemfontein and Port Elizabeth, Nelson Mandela Metro that have them, and then the other places you seem to be expanding them to seem to be smaller places. So it wasn't clear last year when you reported why you were picking them. So I'm pleased that you are reevaluating the criteria.
Thanks. I just want to know how many people have you appointed for the capturing of the information for the register? And when are they going to be starting, if they haven't yet?
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Honourable Member. We have 11 people appointed, 11 on bodies. Thank you. On bodies. Okay, and then, we advertised one AUD post and one secretary post that we're going to fill very soon. AUD, assistant director post. Assistant director post. Okay.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. There's basically one question I needed to respond to, and it came both from the chairperson and Ms. Lani Majake. The first one was it links to the demarcation and the sheriff's point of offices and their accessibility. Firstly, Chair, the demarcation board is an important role player in the demarcation process, because maps can only be owned by one institution. If we're going to allow people to write, to draft maps across the country, around the municipalities and Cape Town, whatever, we'll lose the authenticity of the maps because we can get so many different. So it's from that perspective that anything that has to do with cities, towns, streets, whatever, is basically housed from one center, so that when any institution of state wants to make reference, they've got authentic maps that they can rely on. So to the extent that we do develop demarcations, the demarcation board is an important partner. But not only the demarcation board, also the Office of the Surveyor General. All aspects relating to landmarks and whatever are in the custody of the Surveyor General, as they are also in the custody of all the deeds of grants, knowing where the land, farms, whatever.
etc. Now, when you do the demarcation process, one must first get understand the area that the jurisdiction of the court covers this area, and secondly, we must get the Surveyor General to do the point-to-point description. And the point-to-point description are dealt in terms of natural beacons and cadastral points, because if you say the jurisdiction of the Cape Town Magistrate Court comes Spin Street and Parliament entry point, we don't know whether Parliament will be here 100 years down the line or whether the Spin Street will be abolished and somebody builds a hotel there. But we are definitely sure that Table Mountains will remain, so as the ocean, and so as the mountain. So that's what they use, that it covers around this point from the mountain to this point of the ocean, and etc. And that's a very delicate process. Those who were here when the Constitution 12 Amendment Act was processed, which changed the boundaries of the provinces, will remember the tedious process. And that's what also informed the interface and the delay and the involved process of the demarcation. Tomorrow we'll be presenting part of the process. Last night we had to go through maps which I have received from the demarcation board, basically indicating what every farm, what portion of every area. If you move Atchinsville from Gauteng to Pretoria, somebody must go and do those landmarks and indicate where it is, so that when an accident occurs in a particular place, people must know which court has got jurisdiction, because your case can be thrown out simply by being at the wrong forum. So that's a very technical process that lawyers take too long to understand. And we ask the people who basically have got the GIS expertise, whatever, to help us to go through it, etc. Now, linked to the process is that the idea is that every municipality must have a court, because already demarcation boards have done the municipalities. The current municipal districts are not linked to municipalities. They are linked to the situation as it was before 1994. So one example is that municipal districts in Pretoria or Tshwane, Cape Town are very different from what the kind of municipal arrangements are. And the municipal arrangement helps in the form of coordination of service delivery aspects across all the overlapping and coordinating systems of government, the police, the metro, whatever. So if you get a traffic ticket at this point of the road, it must go to the right court, because now if you get the metro police of Johannesburg issuing tickets and the court that they've got jurisdiction is Kempton Park, it causes a fragmentation in the system, whatever, etc. So the alignment is important from that aspect. And that the process of alignment looks into how do we locate the courts and the demarcations with the municipalities. Obviously, the challenge is that some of the protected municipalities will not have the infrastructure. The court will be outside the municipality. So we have to come with a process of making sure that that court or those outside have got jurisdiction across the municipal area for the meantime, until such time that there are courts that are going to be built within those municipalities. So it's that kind of series of process. Linked to the sheriff, then, the idea is that for every municipality, there must be a court and there must be a sheriff lying to the jurisdiction. Whereas, what we have also, with the Sheriff Amendment Act, which has now been passed and must be put into operation, the idea is that to the extent that there are areas, as you will know, sheriff is a private enterprise. And it depends on people applying, because they can be able to make business out of that environment. The reality is that some of the districts cannot accept any application. People are not willing to come to be a sheriff, because you must put an office, you must have staff, you must have a computer, you must have a party, you must have a storage, you must, all those things are what you put in before you get any, before you start serving a service for which you must get a tariff paid by the person who has sent you to serve a sheriff issued through the court. Now, if you go to Peter State, whatever it is in the Free State, the area is very small, so that the person who is upon the sheriff says, look, I can't get money to sustain my office, to pay salary, because the number of processes, number of documents I receive per year are less than 200, and they give me less than 20,000 rands. And as a result, it's a losing business. So the actual part will look into those districts which are not sustainable themselves. The state government can then look at assigning those responsibilities to state officials, registrars, whatever, to serve processes to the extent that it promotes access to justice for those people.
Springfield, Johannesburg, you almost got competition when the posts are vacant. Many people want to apply, etc. So you will not find all the, you will not find a situation where all the material diseases have perished. You will still find ones where there's none. And where there's none, that's what the Act seeks to address, that we put measures in place that at least there's a body, there's a person who will be able to do that. The interim arrangement we do now is that where there's no sheriff, a sheriff from an adjacent district must be asked to come and self-process it. And I'm not willing to do that in most of the cases because it's an extra cost. Firstly, the rules of the court says you can only charge from the court of the from the issuing court to your place of where you serve. So if a sheriff of Cape Town go and serve outside a district, the sheriff can only charge fees from the court in that district to the place of residence, which means you must subsidize your own travel from your own place to go to the next district. That is not recoverable from the other from the court fees. When you recover from what you get from that district, your place of residence where you serve the summons. So those are the complications of the system, and the alignment process seeks to do that arrangement. The part of the transformation process underway, through the rules, through the board for sheriffs and the rules board, are to make sure that at the end of the day those things are accessible, but also that information that is being published, that people understand, knows who the sheriff is. It was only for the first time this year that the minister announced in the government gazette names of sheriffs and others they serve. And for the first time that you have said at the court, they must keep notice board of the sheriffs around the court. Because when people have got an issue in divorce court, the first thing they go to the nearest court to go and find information. So if they find information on notice board, it will be easier to understand, oh, the sheriff of this place is Mr. XYZ, he has a telephone number, whatever, he has the address, he has the street, whatever. And the board for sheriffs is helping a great deal around this aspect. And Advocate Mohammed is the department sheriff in the OCZ board and helps to ensure that all those kinds of transformation processes takes off the ground as we move forward. And there he said the back, and he can attest to what I said, Chair. Thank you.
It comes from people who have experiences in their constituencies and how people have to travel long distances. That's the only concern around this, Mr. Skosana, through you, DG, and the fact that the demarcation board is constantly demarcating, and which means that you in turn must also be aligning all the time. And you may find a situation where today I'll walk down the road to the Cape Town Magistrates Court, but tomorrow, because of the demarcation board, I'll be required to jump into my vehicle or pay transport costs to go all the way to Kales River. I'm just using that as a hypothetical example. You want to add to that?
Yes. Chair, even the Civil Courts Act bill, which has been passed, takes care of that arrangement. It provides the demarcation board and the provinces are being used as guidelines. That's why the message that will align as far as practical, where it does not hinder access to justice. Now, if the court, the Maluti or whatever area of the High Court, even if that area is outside the province, if the High Court, if the people in Kokstad can see the High Court and change the act, but if a boundary goes across them, the minister through the act,
Hypothetically.
If people can see wherever they are, they can see the court, but that court is in a different district. The act allows the minister to annex that part to fall under the court where it is nearest. So we are not concerned about the changes that happens, whatever. Hence, even the debate whether it will ever happen, that provinces change the way they are, the court can still take the jurisdiction that promotes and enhances access to justice. Thank you.
Thank you for clarification, Mr. Kosana, on the issue of sheriffs, which is actually something that is very contentious. And I think we need to actually fast-track processes in terms of restructuring this whole area. And also, I think more than also just the location of the offices, what's also important is ethical principles within these offices, how these offices are actually run. Where you would actually find stories of people indicating that when somebody's coming to serve, they actually interrogate the person who's supposed to be serving for whatever reason, and also wanting to say that because you haven't actually stated clear reasons why you're subpoenaing, will then regard it as a non-service. So I think it's about how ethical also these services are, seeing that it's a service that the Department of Justice is actually outsourcing. And maybe moving forward, I like the idea that the state is taking over. And maybe, who knows, it might actually work out if in a metro it's actually known that this office, a big office that everybody knows and understands, is the one that is the sheriff's office. Rather than find that there are some offices that are almost like in a warehouse, somewhere in some obscure area where somebody would find it difficult, and when people come in, they even are looked at suspiciously. So those are some of the things that we need to look at, because they actually don't really help to promote access to justice in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Very good. Just on the boundaries issue, as I understand it, the problem isn't so much the physical boundaries, but it's the non-alignment of other government services that may intersect, and it's particularly the social workers. So, for example, my former constituency, Richmond KZN, the social workers covered the municipal area. Yet there's an area, a place called Hopewell, Thornville,
yeah.
is on the way to Maritzburg. That falls under the Maritzburg Court.
Okay.
So when the social workers have a foster care grant matter which has to go to the magistrate's court, the Richmond social workers have to do all the work in Hopewell, but then they have to travel to Maritzburg, from Richmond to Maritzburg, to have the matter heard in the Maritzburg court. That was the sort of problem. I imagine it would extend to child justice matters as well, where the social workers would be based in one place, but the court jurisdiction would be for another town, and it would increase the pressure on them.
Yeah.
So I think that part of it is also ensuring good interaction and communication with social development. I think on child justice there is this, I see the trafficking bill is going through the NCOP unamended, and then you've got rid of all your funny committee, all your little committees. But I think that would be a forum for discussing it, to ensure that social development particularly and the social workers are aligned to the court boundaries.
I understand that I'm understanding Mr. Skosana properly, because I've raised this at the Magistrates Commission, that you can't possibly have a situation where the municipality, the boundaries of the municipality determine the magisterial district. They're completely separate, right? I mean, you only use the boundaries and the reason we're doing a redemarcation is because they are still based on the old boundaries. But, I mean, it's not necessarily so that as soon as the boundaries of the municipality change, that then the magistrate's court must also change. Yeah, no, that's not how I understood it, so I just wanted to clarify that is correct. And then we really need to get this finished now, because it's been going on since who knows when. And, I mean, the other day, for example, Wittenberg Bay has not been proclaimed as its own district for years. And they just shut down the court, the periodical court, and they just closed it. So it's affected everybody, and it needs to be dealt with.
Not much crime there, I believe. Courts get closed down. Did you? Oh, sorry, Mr. Skosana is raising his hand. Did you?
Just to close on the issue raised by Honourable Member Jeffrey, yes, we have established in each region a regional coordination committee, RCC, which basically pulls all the stakeholders from the province that are focused, that are involved in the court work, the corrections, development, home affairs, so that all those aspects can find alignment at the structure. As I've said, that any change of district, whatever, affect all many sort of services. So it's important that they all come in one place. So that informed by that report, the minister can then be able to say that this kind of arrangement will help coordinate services moving forward, etc. And Shefa is right. We use the demarcations as the basis, but obviously we look at a broader aspect of access to justice as we move on. And the process is reaching its conclusion in terms of the report. But implementation thereof is aligned to the National Development Plan. If you look at Chapter 8 of that plan, it deals with all the historical legacy of the spatial disconnection between people, etc. And some of them relate to issues of infrastructure, relate to issues of people movement, migration patterns, whatever. And all those things are basically looked in that broader perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm left with two questions. I guess the most difficult one because I... Oh, yeah, there's one more.
Thanks, Chair. I think there's one question and another one for clarity. Honorable Member Adams asked about the vacancy rate in terms of the raw numbers. We had 18,474 funded posts. 1,865 were vacant, and were filled 16,609. And at SMS level, the vacancy rate is 17%. We had 195 funded posts, 33 were vacant, and 162 were filled. I hope it answers the question. And the one on OSD, I just wanted to clarify, as Advocate Basson alluded to, the change in the occupational class is a problem because the determination is already done at the General Public Service Sectorial Bargaining Council. But as Justice, we have requested the Department of Public Service and Administration to reopen the discussion because the manner in which the agreement was done has led to the disparities in terms of supervisory level individuals. And honorable members and colleagues will note that this OSD is highly reliant on experience, and it's one of the problems that we've discovered that if somebody's at SMS level and they've got 5 years experience and they have to supervise somebody with 20 years experience, then there's going to be a disparity in terms of the financial aspects. However, the latest is that DPC is not that keen because the unions and everybody saying this was signed and sealed, but we're trying to negotiate with. We're supposed to have had a meeting on the 23rd of February with the DG of DPSA. And one of the things that we want to advise is for them to consider the health model, because in the health model, everybody's anointed OSD. Then you don't have a supervisor who is not OSD supervising people who are under the OSD dispensation. So we hope that once we have that interaction, it will help with addressing that historical challenge that we found ourselves in. Thanks.
Chair, may I just get the personnel for the sexual offences within vulnerable groups? Just to clarify the issue, there is a sexual offences lies within the directorate called Victim Support and Specialized Services. So there is two components there. There is a director, and within specialized services, which is sexual offences itself, there's a deputy director, two admin officers, and a clerk. But also parallel to that, you have a director for National Register for Sexual Offences. The director has two assistant directors, one admin officer, and four data capturers. So besides this current establishment, we are in the process of really looking at the way vulnerable groups is constituted, you know, because over time we've lumped in a lot of functions. So we are in the process of rationalizing that, so that it is properly constituted. And I think in the light of the challenges nationally around, you know, sexual offences, we will pay specific attention on the subcomponent on sexual offences so that it is properly capacitated. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick one on the CFO question, we re-advertised, we now shortlisted, and we are interviewing as soon as after the minister is available. So we hope this now is going to be for keeps. We didn't succeed the last time I had reported that we had gone through that process. We didn't succeed, so we are going through the process again. And then, insofar, so then I'm left with two questions, Chair, all together. The first one is the one that came from Honourable Member Smart on the allegations against an official in the department based in Gauteng region. It is indeed correct that I had reported that the matter had been referred specifically to the responsible official to whom this one is accountable and report, and there was not too much progress. I then requested very specifically Advocate Ratman to not to investigate, but to consolidate all the various reports that had been made against the same official. That process was concluded. He concluded with a report. During this process, I was in a different process with somebody else, and of course, it really needed a lot of time. That other process. So that one is now out of the way, completed. This process now relating to the regional head has just started. We are in exchange of processes between the two. So we hope to conclude it, but I do not have the deadlines as yet. But the matter is on hand, and I think we can leave comfort that we are not not dealing with the matter. Then the last question, which I think is the most difficult of the questions that I have to handle today, is the one on the decisions, the assessment of the decisions of the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court, and some things that had been said in the media on that issue. Chair, let me just redirect a bit before I answer this question. In the document that we published, we were very clear on what we wanted to achieve. We said there are many things, but I just want to focus myself on two. One, we said we will assess, of course, the decisions of the Constitution. We didn't say we will review. We just said we will assess. And if you go to page Roman numeral 2 of that document, it's item Roman numeral 2, section D. We are saying a critical assessment of the executive branch of government in implementing laws and court decisions. And in this particular case, we meant that it's not just the assessment of the decisions. We want to see what the Constitutional Court has been saying over the years. How have we been faring as against performance on some of the areas that the Constitutional Court would have demanded or, I don't know, would have judged that we needed to do certain things? And that is what we were saying. And the context, therefore, was that all of this information is going to inform, amongst other things, it will inform a lot of things, but amongst other things which are key, it was going to inform how we position our constitutional development branch in terms of just pushing these issues and engaging and dealing with the issues of Chapter 3 of the Constitution at its intergovernmental level, just to see that this work is being done. But secondly, and I think most importantly, we were already anticipating that we are going to get to a 20-year review, and this information must be fed into a 20-year review, looking back and saying how far have we come. Of course, our intentions went slightly beyond our expectations, and so that is that I think is what I guess overtook everything that we were trying to do. Now, coming back to The specific questions relating to the tendering process, and I really wish to clarify what I intended to say, which I probably did not say correctly, is that we had published a tender following the publication of the document and all of that. We received responses, and this is where I said they were disappointing. I can't remember the exact word I used. Now, what I meant was that we received responses of people who had gone in blocks. We had anticipated we were going to receive a lot of numbers of respondents to our tender, but people came in blocks, so block A, block B, block C, so we had very few blocks. Now, that was the first issue. The second issue, obviously, related to the assessment, the adjudication process of that tender, and there were a number of issues that were raised by the people who were going to adjudicate, who we regarded as experts in this area of law. Now, they advised us to make certain adjustments to the document, which we did. Now, when I said we've since identified a certain group to work with us, this is what I meant, and I just need to clarify that, lest I be held in contempt of Parliament. I meant to say, and this is what I'm trying to clarify, that the people who had tendered, we didn't think that we will get much more other than those who had tendered. So we've cleaned out the document as was guided by the adjudication committee. We've returned to all of those people that had, those organizations that had tendered, and we said, this is now how we've cleaned the document. In other words, everybody, without excluding anybody who would have applied previously. And we've said, please look at it and see if you will make us the same proposal that you had made us. And also including physically this document that we had published, because there was a small technicality that the document itself was not handed to the people at the time. So that's just the clarity. Now, that process is supposed to be concluded, all of it, in June. Is it in June? Yeah. But we are targeting work to commence in June. So when I was saying they are working on it yesterday, I realized that maybe I just said it very, very, I guess, loosely. But I meant they are now working on what we had given them and what we had amended. Chair, if that clarity could be accepted.
I'm sure, not sure which document that you seem to have it to. You seem to have it to hand. Which is the document that you ended choosing? Which one called what?
Chairperson, it's the same document.
And what exactly is it that they didn't supply? What you yesterday called negative results, and here you describe as I'm not sure what word you said. Your own intentions now went beyond the expectations. You mean the expectations of the tenderers, of the people bidding? And I'm still not clear what it was that disappointed you so much. I mean, they were probably proposing to look at the tariff. But what is it that didn't meet your requirements? Is it what they wanted to do with it? I'm still not clear what was wrong.
And what these experts came in and helped you with, so that there's now a new take on what must be delivered.
Different issue, but on what the DG has raised, on.
All right, sir.
Yeah. No, but this. I don't know if my question on the Secretary General was answered. Was it answered yesterday?
No,
no, okay.
I'm completely off the subject.
No, but it's
we'll
part of. It's part of her. She's given an overall report, and then the other point was that the tabling of the policy on the sexual offences, which was.
Chair, we're completely off the point. We're
still
in
the middle of the
discussing
the DG's responded on a number of issues, including
this last one that Ms. Smuts is very interested in.
But we're not finished with it.
The DG's finished her report. I'm then just questioning issues that she's left out.
All right, let the DG respond to Smuts' follow-up questions, Mr. Jackson. If you could switch your mic off, please, Ms. Smuts. DG.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Just to provide further clarity, and of course I do not wish to go through the details of the tender process as I've indicated, but I to provide further clarity, what disappointed us was the responses we had received in terms of the magnitude, in terms of the timeline, those types of things. So those were the issues, because we thought this project, you would recall that we had anticipated a certain period within which this project could be done. And the responses were suggesting something completely different. And so those were some of the issues, which is why the evaluation team had to advise us to rework certain elements so that we see whether we will get the same outcome. Yeah, so that would go to those issues, but I do not want to go to the details.
Is there any reason, Chair, in policies that we cannot ask for the rejigged document that is now going out to the same tenderers? Is there any reason why we can't ask to see that?
I don't know if it's much asking me, but I can't answer. DG, I'm not sure if you're able to answer that.
I cannot answer, Chair. I do know that the procurement regulations and the procurement processes demand that things get absolutely confidential until the process is closed. Anything beyond that, I guess, is something that can be considered at that level, at that point. If members would, if I could perhaps venture. Advice. I would request that we refrain from doing so until the process is closed. Thank you.
I'm aware that Ms. Schaefer asked about corruption at the Soweto court, but what did I miss an answer to my question on corruption in the registrar's office at South Carthage? Thank you. Then I will follow up privately with the DG.
We have the answer, but.
Mr. Jeffrey. Ask Ms. Smuts if I can ask my...
No, you don't have to ask Ms. Smuts. Ask any.
Okay. No, it was just the DG, I think, was trying to finish all the questions that she had, and the one on the Secretary-General and the relationship between the Secretary-General and this committee. I mean...
I thought we could just invite him, request his presence, and then engage with him. That's how I understood it.
Okay, but then, you know, they're there. Why is she not here now? Is she going to be part of this budget process? That's really the one. The other then is, so that may be more a thing for the committee, but the other issue is the sexual offences policy or the strategic plan. The national policy framework. The DG said it had been tabled. Nobody else seemed to know anything about that, or the civil society group Chukumisa complained it wasn't.
Yeah.
When the DG said it had been tabled, everyone was quite baffled. It was then established that it was tabled, but it had been added onto, I think it had been missed because it had been part of some other document. But it just is a problem. I mean, I think... The complaint from Chukumisa was about the two staff members. Okay, we've had the report that it's more, but I think that more work needs to be done in terms of engaging with civil society on sexual offences to avoid these miscommunications.
Ms. Schaefer, on this particular point?
This one and the last one. Yeah, I don't know if Mr. Jeffrey's baffled. He mustn't attribute that to the rest of us. I've got a copy of the framework, and it's a thick document, which was tabled last year.
You never went to
the meeting. I did. Maybe I wasn't listening, but I definitely wasn't baffled by it. Secondly, I just on the tender issue, I mean, my understanding of tender processes is that the process itself must be confidential. But if you've advertised a tender on a certain basis and you're not going to put the tender out on a different basis, then surely that document should not be confidential, because technically you would have had to generally go through the advertising process again for more tenders. The fact that you've decided just to go back to those individuals is your decision to make, but I can't see that document is confidential.
I did not say it was confidential. I said I would encourage that we wait for the process, because generally the process has to be protected in that sense. That's all I said. I think I remain with that cautionary advice. Thank you very much. Then, with regards to the SG and her accountability, members would recall that the office of the Chief Justice is the department for now, whilst we are looking at an ultimate end state, whatever the end state would turn out to be. So because of that, as an accounting officer, having recently been appointed and recently assumed office, but also the issues that I had discussed earlier when we dealt with this issue, it will be necessary for her in the future to start attending Parliament. It is an error that I really wish to admit to. When we received the notice, we started working on the presentation. I did forget to invite her specifically, but I did send her text, I think, a day before, I think on the 16th, but of course it was late then. And she also had not proposed to do so, because Dr. Divier, remember, was acting there and was coming with us all the time. And I think in the future, once we've sorted out all of these issues, indeed she will be representing that office in her own right, not as part of us.
Yes, that's the point I wanted to make.
Thank you,
DG and Mr. Jeffrey. The Office of the Chief Justice is a separate department, and I would feel uncomfortable if the Secretary General came as part of this delegation, because she's not part of the Department of Justice, well, to all intents and purposes. Yes. And so we would have to include the Secretary General as part of our budgetary engagement, in the same way that we ask the NPA and the SIU and everyone else to appear before us. Okay. Do you think we should invite her now in this period? I'm just asking. We should. All right. I can't hear you.
Or perhaps we ought to go and call, because we've never visited the OCJ office, which I think has moved buildings since the most incipient days. No, the OCJ, the office of the Chief Justice, it's not at the Concord.
It's
a brand new institution.
I didn't know that myself, did you?
No, it wasn't. I mean, even when Richard was the Secretary General, they were in a certain building. I thought they'd move from that building to another, but maybe I'm wrong. But I think I do not wish to leave Cape Town, but I think it might be perfectly appropriate for us to go and call on a brand new institution and a very exciting new departure.
Well, now that you've raised it, with my little management committee, we had agreed that we'd bring this to your attention and say that must be part of our oversight work. But we need to plan very carefully, given that this is the year before election, that we fit it in properly and include a few magistrates' courts, the South Gauteng High Court, amongst others. But we had planned to do that some other time, not now. So we'll include that, all right? But it's a visit to the Concord and a visit to the OCJ, all right? DG, where is the OCJ's office? Fox Street, Johannesburg. Wow. Okay. Infamous Fox Street. All right. Mr. Romano, we must invite the Secretary General. Um, Yeah, we need to just don't just bring her here and pump her with questions, and Doctor, you would need to assist and guide her, because it would be her first time, and understandably, I would imagine, I may be wrong, but I would imagine she'd be very nervous. Well, all right.
On a serious note, I mean, one of my major concerns is that...
I think we will, seriously.
Okay, well, it was a bit of a sideline, it wasn't. But, I mean, I do think it's important that we... One of my major concerns regarding the separate establishment of the Chief Justice's office is that although it's good in principle, in practice it can be stifled with inadequate budget. And I think it's actually very important that we do hear from them whether the budget allocated to them is sufficient for what they need to do.
All right. Is there anything else? Did you? No? No. I think we must have a break. Let's have a 15-minute break, and then we'll reconvene. We'll reconvene at 11.